Welcome to Season of the Glitch. I'm your host, Kelly, and I'm glad you're here, and hoping the simulation has been treating you well today. Season of the Glitch is an only slightly dystopian culture podcast here to distract you as we hurtle toward climate collapse, our cubicle on Mars, or the singularity. We talk about film and television here, art, the news cycle, and some of the more insidious and exciting developments in our technological lives. If you stay with me today, we'll continue our now pretty untimely recap of the Oscars and cinema in 2023. If you're back from last time, thanks for being back. And if you're new, there is a part one to this. Basically, last week, I talked about each of the Best Picture nominations plus a few other films, but I left one out. I had a little more to say about the Barbie movie because I had written down some thoughts about it over time as the discourse evolved. Now I feel a little badly about it because it's not like the film was over-recognized at all. I think it only won for what, best song? I still think it's worth it to just get into it, follow through, and wrap it up. And then I want to talk about what I think is the most under-recognized film of 2023. So we're going to get into that. Let's jump right into it today. It's funny because I didn't see the Barbie movie for a long time because the online discourse put me off. I think a lot of artists have said this in many ways over the years, but I found myself thinking about something I remembered from the South Park guys in 6 Days to Air. To paraphrase, they mentioned that instead of deciding what your agenda is and then building a narrative to deliver that, you start by exploring whatever it is about a narrative that intrigues you or makes you laugh. And the themes and your politics and ideologies will naturally reveal themselves. They can be naturally embedded in the stories that you want to tell as an artist. It's a comment on craft that simplifies a process for avoiding art that is didactic and trite. Sometimes it feels like the woke and anti-woke coalitions are approaching an equilibrium where they feel equally annoying and as laughable as the alarmist reactions from men's rights activists and people like Matt Walsh were to the Barbie movie, saying that it was a bellwether that women wanted to dominate men or whatever. Barbie did seem so predetermined. I had doubts that a $1 billion grossing Mattel ad with tie-ins to every imaginable product, including cultural nadir like The Bachelorette, could really be subversive and progressive. But I don't like when people judge art without seeing it based on buzz or their echo chambers, so I had to give it a chance. I waited until it was on HBO Max. I tried to go in with an open and fun mind, and I don't know, you all. The aesthetics and jokes kind of give me SNL Digital Short. The art direction was fine, but surprisingly mid. Do you remember back in the day when photos of those rollerblading outfits leaked? That may have been the peak of my visual interest. And did we need another Kubrick Ape parody, considering there's already one in everything ever made? Did we need a cringe voiceover to explain everything we were already seeing on screen? I thought it was very didactic. Everything was explicit and the jokes felt familiar. It's the Taylor Swift effect. If you want to make top dollar, you can't have any abstraction or untested ground in your product. Ryan Gosling is pretty funny, but I wish Barbie had given me something new to think about in terms of feminism and patriarchy. It was trite. Maybe it was for kids, I don't know. I think it's for the middle class, basic women who want to access feminism in the safest, most accessible way, in a way where they're not going to lose control, and above all, in a way that rafts them safely in consumerism. It's odd that the ideas in Barbie are so trite and broad. This idea that Barbie and Marilyn Monroe are the ultimate conceptual battleground for women's oppression because they're blonde and well-dressed and, I guess, vessels for imagination, has been around a long time and it seems so irrelevant to me. I think it sprung from second-wave feminism's deconstruction of beauty standards and then was honed as a Gen X thing when culture did its shadow work in the 90s. It gave us Courtney Love, who was doing the unpalatable, through-the-looking-glass version of Barbie or Marilyn. Courtney's Barbie emerging from a swamp on heroin to throw makeup at Madonna at an award show was better, actually. Those were important times, but they were also very polemic. It's like a baby doll dress with combat boots. It's obvious. So Greta Gerwig, that's your big idea, Barbie, but she's a badass. What's funny is I connected with some of Greta's earlier projects because they had a niche contemporary biographical feminism. Frances Ha was great, so was Mistress America. And I related to those because they were about intelligent young women who graduated with creative degrees and struggled with their place in the corporate world and workforce. Those were films about the patriarchy. They were subtle and genuine. It was basically write what you know. An older woman suggested I didn't like the Barbie movie because I was too young to understand the patriarchy, which is like, don't worry, I still get wage gapped. I still have to worry about getting murdered. But groups of women dressed in pink, flash mobbing the theater, felt more like a bachelorette party than a revolution to me. It's just something I feel alienated from, like Disney adults and Swifties. And I'm aware that I can't access Barbie joy for a myriad of personal reasons. And I have had friends tell me to chill out because the movie's for children or for women who aren't exposed to the of-the-minute discourse. And while I disagree that children's entertainment needs to be condescending, it's fine and I get it, but I just wanted to talk about it. As for the doll, I loved playing with Barbies growing up, especially the clothes. I love the tactility of the soft clothes sliding over the hard plastic. She was stimulating. I honestly have always doubted that Barbie had such a detrimental effect on beauty standards and self-esteem for girls and women. We get plenty of that, but Barbie's form was so obviously alien and unrelated to that of a human that it almost seems that updating her with accurate proportions actually pushes her more toward the uncanny valley, where these supposedly harmful comparisons might happen. She's a freak. She's built more like the final form of the aliens in Under the Skin than any child, and I don't know, I kind of support that. I also think her design is just ergonomic. She's long and thin, so a small hand can grasp her like a dagger. As a kid, I'd play with friends if I could, but playing with Barbie alone was fine too. I had the house and car, and maybe a half dozen dolls. Back then, I kept a notebook about the plot developments in my play sessions, so there would be continuity from session to session. In that way, I was playing as a film director or writer, which proves it was a developmentally hardy toy. Once I left the notebook at a friend's house, and her mom read it, threw it away, freaking out because she found something inappropriate in there. Probably some poorly understood romantic drama that I'd pay to read today. The natural perversity of childhood imagination is what helps prepare us to handle the eventual traumas of life. And now I know my Barbies were just like the atavistic mannequin that Carl Jung carved and carried around as a child, receiving from it the messages from the collective. Barbie was weird and kids made her weirder, but the Barbie movie isn't weird. It only touches on the doll as a subversive outlet without ever letting itself get carried away the way we got carried away in our childhood play sessions. It sticks to its agenda, panders to the identity conversation, and stays close to the surface as a result. Maybe I just have oppositional defiance disorder, but when there's a big, literal message, I tend to duck. But maybe if the Barbie movie had just trusted itself and the audience a little bit more, had operated partially in its own subconscious in honor of the deep play and weirdness it pointed to, but was afraid to actually visit, we could have hit a vein. So let's have fewer billion-dollar toy commercials that use doctrine to justify themselves and more risk-taking in our art in 2024. Or not. I hear a rumor that Lena Dunham is going to do Polly Pocket next. So maybe Greta's next project should really dig in. Evil Grimace has been trending on TikTok, so maybe something with that. Or how about a $2 billion Count Chocula epic? Dig into that cultural cachet. Lena Dunham should remake Oppenheimer with an all-girl cast to really trigger the manosphere like the Ghostbusters remake. Oh my god, hear me out. What if we bombed Japan, but it was just a glitter bomb? That would be amazing. What if it was Fat Man and Little Boy, but Fat Woman and Little Girl, and they were just bath bombs? Ben Shapiro is going to lose his mind when he finds out about nuclear self-care. I love the smell of pumpkin spice napalm in the morning. Speaking of Ghostbusters remakes, and what Nietzsche called the dread of the eternal return, I've had the dire misfortune of being forcibly shown the Ghostbusters Frozen Empire trailer a couple of times now, and the aesthetic of this movie is as if someone asked ChatGPT what the original Ghostbusters was about, ran that response through a sentence randomizer, then fed that back into Midjourney, then asked a six-year-old to describe the resulting images, and then ran those descriptions back through Midjourney. This is not the uncanny valley. This is the unsentient valley, an airless and soulless void to be safely explored only by the most vapid of consumers. Overprocessed ghosts aside, the true horror story here is seeing Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray in their career end stages as pod people whose free will has been hijacked by some brain-smoothing agent developed by yesterday's NFT bros, which has left them incapable of doing anything other than looking plasticized and droning through lines that an AI wrote while scabbing past the writer's strike. All for that big paycheck that they can only pray buys them a seat on the SpaceX escape rocket when climate collapse causes the actual Frozen Empire. Look, I know I got a little cynical about the Barbie movie and summer blockbusters, but there's no reason to despair. For every one of these monstrous cash grabs, there seems to be something special blooming as movies really are back. Joseph Campbell said that myths are public dreams, and dreams are private myths, a meditation which I've heard technologized as films are public dreams, dreams are private films. The first hour of Beau is Afraid is the best public nightmare in cinematic form since Mulholland Drive, and I don't mess around with Mulholland Drive. The rest of the film is a welcome, if not demanding indulgence into creative experimentation by Ari Aster that he knows he's earned after creating two tight masterpieces of horror, Midsommar and Hereditary. Aster's supposed diversion from horror was actually a return to form if you've watched his bananas short films and their Oedipal themes. I guess I'm Ari Aster's target audience in that I love being scared and scandalized by visionary creativity, and I don't mind some depravity to get there, especially if it's hilarious. I like for art to upset me on some level. And I think that affiliation is paradoxically because I'm pretty sensitive. It keeps me from dissociating from the world or something. Like many people, I got into Aster's work when the Hereditary trailer went viral in 2018 with some speculation that it could be the scariest movie ever. And as someone who has cheerfully spared their brain no sort of imagined horror since I could form sentences, Hereditary bears the distinction of being one of the only adult viewing experiences I can recall wherein I was actually not okay. From the shockingly early dispatch of the presumed main character's head until the batshit climax went nuclear with demonic mommy issues, I quietly freaked the fuck out in the theater until Both Sides Now, the Judy Collins version no less, chimed its melancholic story of lost innocence over the credits. By the time Midsommar came out a year later, I was initiated into the cult. I was primed for the ingredients that make an Aster film, a protagonist undergoing a mental health crisis that makes him highly sympathetic, but also a highly unreliable narrator, sick, quasi-incestuous and hilarious family dynamics, dazzling layers of world and meaning-building through art objects and art installations, violence that plays to our primordial phobias, including inventive forms of head trauma as a particular motif. Midsommar announced itself as folk horror by replacing Hereditary's dark palette with sun-drenched pale yellows laced with Beltane jewel tones, aesthetically tying it to vintage genre exemplars like Wicker Man. The lightness may have eased the jump scares and lured the viewer into a false sense of safety, but a Hitchcockian dread thrummed harder than ever throughout. Locating the horror in the daytime was the next level. If Hereditary made me want to get serious about therapy again, Midsommar made me want to cut the middleman and just drop my brain in the washing machine. So, a 4-year break before getting a new Astor film was probably for the best. Still, I saw Beau Is Afraid on opening night, eager to dive back into the vibe, with my brain more weathered by a global pandemic and the life changes that spanned it. And dive I did. The first act is an unqualified tour de force with traces of David Lynch, not so much stylistically, but that it managed to get dream logic onto film, with a trueness that approaches Mulholland Drive. And also, surprisingly, John Carpenter, with its uniquely frenetic and comedic action caused by a perceptive gap between the seeing and unseeing characters. Beau Is Afraid was perfect for about 40 minutes, with Neuralink levels of immersion into the mind of a highly paranoid or visionary or both person, and it was very, very funny. It was mood-altering art, literally. I felt like I was high when I wasn't. And I thought, Astor can't possibly land all of this. And then he didn't. And that's okay. Joaquin Phoenix plays Beau like a demented Paddington bear, complete with a tender drive to reunite with his family, a plump, worn, and often naked physique, and a metaphysical please look after this bear tag, as he waddles out into a world that plays like They Live took place inside of Grand Theft Auto. His hero's quest, revealed in an opening therapy session, is a rare visit home to his billionaire CEO mother. He just needs to visit the drugstore, fill his new prescription, and get a good night's sleep, then go to the airport. But to achieve these mundane objectives, Beau must run through a gauntlet of traumatic accusations, home invasions, and violent assaults. It's like one of those dreams where you need to take a final you haven't studied for and get to the airport for a flight that leaves in just a few minutes, but you realize you've lost a pet in a snowstorm, the moonbeams are poisonous, and your legs suddenly don't work. With every step forward, there's a new set of challenges branching off, and Astor's talent lets us feel the ferocity of these experiences like we're wearing a VR helmet. That identification is the difference between an effectively glib horror flick and a truly psychedelic one. It's the difference between a jump scare and a psychic wipeout. After the ingenious setup, Beau Is Afraid unspooled some, and as it got more challenging, it also veered into more familiar, if lovely, territory. Primarily Charlie Kaufman, and also medium-forward work like Scanner Darkly-era Linklater or Michel Gondry, and easier, high-concept fare like The Truman Show. If you've seen Astor's early short films, you will recognize, in Beau Is Afraid, his loop back from prestige horror to some original themes, messed-up families, quasi-incestuous stuff, transgressive obsessions, and the big laughs those things can return. But like in Hereditary, in Beau Is Afraid, Astor sets up a lot of ambiguity about the reliability of the protagonist's perspective, and it really works. But then he ditches that for supernatural explanations, which redeem the protagonist, but I find personally less interesting. Beau's trip to his mom's house gets derailed when his en route phone call to her is intercepted by a UPS guy, voiced by Bill Hader, in case you missed that. He informs Beau that he's found his mother with her head crushed by a falling chandelier. Death styles of the rich and famous, I suppose. This fancy pulverization was brilliant when played as just another in a string of our horrified Beau's imagined inconveniences, like having his house key stolen or his water shut off when he needs to take his meds. But then a maze of exposition reveals that Beau may have come by his predicaments honestly, that they are the result of real-world conspiratorial mechanizations rather than his faulty neural wiring. And his dead mom becomes a major plot point instead of another bravura punchline, the film loses some of its punch. There's some uniqueness of vision that's lost as the humor broadens into the goofy, anything-goes surrealism of an improv session, and at times I felt more interested in the swank, brutalist architecture of Mom's mansion than in Beau's increasingly free association hallucinations, which climax in a talking Jabba the Hutt-esque penis freudianly slobbering away as a stand-in for Beau's absent father. That's the second time in recent cinematic memory that a favorite contemporary director, Alex Garland, jettisoned medical-grade psychological suspense for some gross-out rubber puppets as a dubious conclusion to an expert setup and left me cold. What can I say? Body horror just may not be my thing. Beau is Afraid is a generous work full of ideas, visions, and great jokes. It's just not tight. A24 and Ari Aster have been carrying the art house torch for some time through a crowded, muddled landscape of middle-brow streaming people-pleaser, and they were well-positioned to blow some money, have some fun, and dig into something new. I adore the wild rush of this film's start, and I'm willing to consider its less satisfying mazes and experiments as potential gateways to some spectacular and fully realized bad trip we'll get to take in the future. I'll be ready. I just want to say that I think we are really seeing a kind of magical recovery from the COVID years. I remember that during full lockdown, it was pretty depressing. People were talking about things like Wednesday and how we don't need to go to the theater anymore. I think a lot of projects were put on ice, so there became a backlog, and now we're seeing a glut of that. But I also think that filmmakers, auteurs, are asserting the importance of 90-minute to 2-hour films again. And I'm very happy to see that definition between screening and cinema again. So I'll be back next week with a new 2-part series that I think you should hear. We're done looking back. We're actually looking forward now in many senses. We'll be looking at some science fiction from a vital contemporary filmmaker who isn't perfect, predictable, or amenable, but is always compelling. In some ways, he's been around a long time, and in other ways, it feels like we're just getting to know him. He made one of my favorite films ever, as well as some that really frustrated me. He has something big coming out right now, one that feels like a summer blockbuster, and it's sure to be divisive. I haven't seen it yet, so I have my fingers crossed that it will deliver. We'll see. Can you guess who it is? I also am going to review Late Night with the Devil, a movie I really liked and I've been gathering my thoughts about, and it ties into some things I have to say about AI and its most recent controversies, so I hope that you will participate in that conversation with me. I want to hear from you about any of this or anything on your mind, so remember to reach out to me. Season of the Glitch is written, performed, and produced by Kelly Shy. Don't be shy. Email me, Kelly with an EY, at seasonoftheglitch.com. I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Season of the Glitch and Twitter at Season of Glitch. That's it for this time. Join me next time. And remember, the machine is a ghost.
It's nice to hear your voice again. I've waited all day long, even wrote a song for you. It's strange the way you make me feel. With just a word or two, I'd like to do the same for you. It's nice to hear you say hello. And how are things with you? I love you. But very soon it's time to go. An office job to do while I'm here writing songs for you. Strange how a phone call can change.